following program is brought to you by your friends at Podcast One.
He's an American icon who fought in World War II, gave you Martin Lewis, Martha Ray, George Gobel, Tennessee Ernie Ford, Andy Williams, Fried Green Tomatoes, Spinal Tap, The Princess Bride, The Sure Thing, Stand By Me, The Declaration of Independence, People for the American Way, and a few TV shows.
Maybe you've heard of a couple of these.
All in the Family, Sanford and Son, Maude, Good Times, The Jeffersons, Hot L, Baltimore, One Day at a Time, Mary Harmon, Mary Harmon, The Dumplings, All's Fair, All the Glitters, Fernwood Tonight, America Tonight, Dippin' Strokes, The Facts of Life, The Baxters, Archie Bunker's Place, Silver Spoons, Gloria, Square Pegs, a.k.a. Pablo, Who's the Boss, 227, Sunday Dinner, The Powers That Be, 704 Houser, Channel Umpteen and 3, One Day at a Time on Netflix.
All of the above with Norman Lear. It's all of the above with Norman Lear. No matter who you are, no matter what you do, you know that Norman Lear is just another version of you.
This is Norman Lear, and what is the title of my show here?
All of the Above.
All of the Above. We're going to cover all of the above. Paul Hipp is at my side here.
Hi, Norman.
It's impossible to cover the all of the above without him.
And I'll cover Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to everybody listening. We haven't, I don't know, have we done a podcast?
Well, depending on.
I think this is the first one in the new year.
Yeah, and depending on how they roll them out. But yeah. This is the first one.
Now, I'm going to tell you something I don't know that I've told anybody but my wife. It's nothing important except that ever since I was a little kid, 18 has been my favorite number.
2018.
I have no idea why, but I love 18. As I say it now, I feel everything I felt as a kid. And here we are in 2018, and God, in America, we're really smoking, aren't we?
Oh, man, are we ever.
I mean, we don't have any problems.
No, 2017 was a breeze. 2018 looks like it's set up to be another easy-going year.
And our first guest on All of the Above at Podcast One is one of the great guys of the Western world. I've only known him some weeks, months. We happen to be working together. And we're doing a new show. We're doing a pilot for NBC about, I don't know if he's of the generation yet. Seems to be a younger man than you and I. No, not than you. He's coming in. There he is.
Okay, and I'm a fan of his work. I've known his work.
Well, let's talk about that before he comes in. Don't let him in here.
But Analyze This, co-wrote Analyze This and Analyze That. I want to find out how they came up with that second title. I mean, that was, you know, just a lot of great TV and stuff. And here he is.
And he is Peter Toland.
And welcome, here I
Peter.
Am.
Welcome. Movies and television.
Very glad to be here.
Why?
As you say, I'm always glad to see you and always, you know, better for it.
Oh, I said that?
Well, you say that many times.
I said I'm glad to see you. I didn't say you're glad to see me. Yeah. But I'm very glad to hear that.
Yeah.
So Peter Toland and I are working on Guess Who Died for NBC, a pilot. And who did we NBC just announced who we cast?
Yes, we've cast Hector Elizondo and Holland Taylor.
Wow.
So we've got a great couple at the center of this. So
yeah.
Excited about that.
That's
I'm excited about that, too. In the course of the first episode, what the show is all about is very much realized in that first episode.
Yeah.
And Peter, talk about where did you start? How did it all come about for you?
I don't know. I mean, I'm still thinking about how that happened. I wanted to be an actor, and I was really terrible. You know, I was really a bad actor. And I flunked out of college and ended up at a theater in Minneapolis, an improv theater called Dudley Riggs Brave New Workshop, and did a lot of writing there, a lot of writing through improv, and was there for a couple of years, moved to New York, was part of a comedy team with a partner, and ended up going to Off-Broadway, and then was finally tired of all that theater money that I was making, that gaudy theater money.
Yeah,
and
big theater cash.
Wow. I think I was married for the first time at that time, and my in-laws were, you know, very suspicious about where my life was going and concerned for their daughter. So I ended up coming to coming out here to L.A.
Was she in theater, that first wife?
No, she was a mostly serious person who had worked, I think, in politics, actually. She'd worked for the Democratic National Committee, organizing the break-ins. or so, I forget what she did, but she was very involved with them. And
what year did you come to L.A.?
90. Hmm. So it's been, I think actually, yeah, it's been about 30 years, which is shocking to me. When I came out here, somebody said to me, be careful about moving to California because you go and the next day you're 70 by the pool.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, my God, I'm 11 years like away from that. You know?
So you had some success. 89, you were off Broadway.
That's right. I did that. I did that show with my partner that I was working with at the time. Off Broadway. And it went well enough. But I think it became apparent to me soon after that that wasn't going to be the trajectory. You know?
So L.A.
Yeah. It was, again, it ran enough. It was not a hit. It was not reviewed, with great accolades. So right. I think I looked at the landscape and thought, I think I better change direction.
And when you came out here, what's the first?
Well, I had...
What was the first day like?
Well, I do have that sense memory of being in L.A. coming from the East that first time and, like, being in, like, a convertible and, like, going down. You know, it's that typical Beverly Hills thing where the Palms are on either side of the street.
And
you just
go,
this is unbelievable. How long has this been going on? And of course, just the idea that you could drive around in the winter with the top down was fantastic.
When I first came out here, my father told me, you buy a convertible in Connecticut.
Yeah.
And you drive it across the country, sell it in California, and you'll make all your expenses.
Did that work?
It was an old of whatever year, I don't remember, some years old. And my wife's daughter and I came out here.
Yeah.
And... Norman Mamie. I remember the name of the lot.
Norman Mamie.
It took me about, I don't know, some weeks to sell it.
Yeah.
And I think I made $50 or lost $50. I don't know. But Norman Mamie, I remember the name Norman Mamie, and I remember, and he owned the lot on Beverly Boulevard near La Brea.
Well, you had one of the epic first days in L.A., of all time.
Oh, you know that story.
I don't think I do.
Yeah, no, I went out to look for, it was a Saturday, but I parked them my wife and daughter in a motel, went out past a little theater on, sometimes I remember the name of the little street, a theater in a home, a 90-seat theater.
Yeah.
Opening tonight, Shaw's Major Barbara, like maybe my favorite play at that age. And a guy was sweeping up outside. He learned that I had just arrived, literally, from a 6 or 7 day trip to Los Angeles. And I told him I wanted to be a press agent, which is what I came here for. Remember that we have a guest, and his name is Paul Tolan, Peter Tolan. And we want to be talking to him, and I'm now telling this.
That's okay.
Holy shit. How did we get to this? So anyway, parked him in wife and daughter in a motel.
Yeah.
And went out to get a Saturday evening newspaper, Sunday morning newspaper on Saturday evening to look for a place. Driving down the little street, their Circle Theater opening tonight. I said all that, Major Barbara. And a guy was sweeping up, and he was the guy who was running the theater. Fascinated that I had a wife and kid parked in a motel, had just arrived. And he said, by the way, I have a seat if you want to see the opening of the show tonight. And I don't know, I think I panicked because I knew I had to call my wife and tell her first night
be late.
In California.
Might not be
sorry, I'm going to the theater. That's the only way it would sound is I'm going to the theater.
Yeah.
Because it also was, you want to be a press agent, you meet a lot of people here, we can't afford to hire you, but it would all be good for me.
You were looking for a gig. That's legit.
Anyway, he's on the aisle in the second row. It's only 90 seats. Three seats in immediately in front of me were roped off. As the lights went down, three people walked in. Alan Mowbray, well-known British actor, Dame somebody, sometimes I remember her name, sometimes I don't, and Charles Chaplin.
Hmm.
I had just noticed in the program that that Sidney Chaplin, who turned out to be his son, was in the was a performer, so that's why Mr. Chaplin was there.
Was it Dame May Whitty?
No, that's the only dame I could think of.
It was not Dame Judi Dench because she would have been.
No,
too.
No,
she was not Dame yet.
Exactly.
Anyway, when it was all over, Charlie Chaplin said that the only way he could pay back for the amount of entertainment he enjoyed that evening was to do something himself. Nobody left. I mean, there was no backstage, so the cast came out and sat on the floor in front of us. And he did a pantomime of of the little guy, the tramp, trying to mail a letter across the way, you know, 10 feet away, in a high wind.
What a welcome to L.A. Welcome to Hollywood.
Yes, Charles Chaplin does some minutes for you.
That is crazy. I think I did read it. I read it in your book, so I think I remember that.
Yeah, so all of this to this point is old hat.
I had that and same experience as you driving down those tree-lined streets.
Oh, yeah.
And driving up, I remember, I'll never forget driving up PCH and seeing surfers, like real surfers.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought the same thing. How long has this been going on? Like, and that mixed with, wow, this is real, the stuff that I've seen on TV.
Yeah. And you always hear in lyrics, you know, the air is perfumed and things like
and
that.
And it
But that was the first time that I went, oh, my God, the air is perfumed. This is, there's something happening.
Yeah.
But I had come out I think I was going to work on Murphy Brown, and I had made the big mistake of actually writing a Murphy Brown spec script, which you're always told, don't write a spec script for the show you want to work on.
Uh-huh.
But I was always hawking my agents and saying, and I was lucky because I did have agents because of the act. And I said, has Diane English read the script? And they go, you're not going to get hired. She's not going to read it. Don't worry. And eventually she did.
Diane English, creator and
of Murphy Brown.
Murphy Brown.
And I did get hired.
From the spec script?
From the spec script.
That was your first job here?
No, because she had a contract dispute with Warner soon after and said, I can't hire you because it has to look like I'm leaving.
Uh-huh.
So I can't hire you. So I had to take another job, and I worked with Carol Burnett.
Oh, is that all?
So, I mean, okay, it's almost like your Chaplin story because you're going, how can I be now working with Carol Burnett?
So on the Carol Burnett show?
No. There was a show called Carol and Company. It was on for a season and a half or two seasons on NBC, which was almost like an anthology series. It was like a different character a week. Not a review. Although we did do one review during the course of it.
Uh-huh.
You know.
She played a different character
every week.
And were they characters we'd be familiar with from her variety show or all new things?
No. It was a very difficult show to write because were, in effect, writing a pilot a week. So I think the first one I did was about two parents who go to they're having financial trouble, and they go and they need to get their kid into college or something, and they're at the bank, and they're fighting. They're divorced, and they're fighting. And in the middle of it, the bank is robbed, and one of the robbers turns out to be their son. it's that kind of thing.
So you had your work in New York from the stage. You got agents. They saw your work there.
Yeah.
And then some success off Broadway.
Yeah.
And then you had things lined up when you came to L.A. with your spec script.
I think so. I think I had been approached by producers because of the plays off Broadway.
Right.
And I didn't want to go to L.A. I had that very sort of Eastern kind of snob, kind of like, oh, well, that's television. That's not for me.
Right.
the theater. My God. You
know, right.
The theater.
Yeah, yeah.
And
existed until not that long ago.
It really did.
Now, you know, major stars want to work in television.
Of course.
Only a few years ago, they did not.
Well, remember, I think it's in Annie Hall, where isn't there a line about they don't have garbage out there, they recycle it and make it into television or something like that? That's a really Eastern attitude, you know. So I didn't go. But I was approaching 30, and things were not looking too bright. So I wrote that spec. And based on the spec and on a play, I'd written four plays that had been produced by that time, all off Broadway.
Wow.
And the last play that I wrote was the most accomplished of them, or at least the most adult. And they sent out the play and the spec script, and I had meetings everywhere. It was fantastic.
Wow, great.
It was great.
And the next job you had as a result of those meetings?
Was with Carol. Yeah, it was supposed to be Murphy Brown. And oddly enough, I wrote two episodes of Murphy Brown the season I wasn't there. I mean, I went to, I think Diane said, okay, can you come? And I said, I can't. I had to take a job. And she goes, well, can you ask them if it would be okay if you wrote? And I thought, does that ever happen?
Wow.
And were they produced?
Yes, they were. Two episodes in the third season before I joined the show in the fourth season.
No, that never happened.
Never happens. Somebody was very kind in allowing that to happen.
Well, your writing is great.
Well, that's, thank you.
There's that.
Maybe.
That helps.
Usually that doesn't. There's no guarantee.
That helps a lot.
I had that several times when I was doing, because I felt like, I used to joke, you know, because I used to walk through New York all the time when I was in my 20s. I'd walk the pavement and I wasn't working other than writing these plays. And I thought, the 20s are my years of, I forget the name I had, but the 30s, years of accomplishment. Uh-huh. The 30s will be my years of accomplishment. And So I worked all the time when I did the was doing Murphy Brown.
Your 30s, not the 30s.
My 30s. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. In the 30s, I was mostly with my father. He was a young boy at the time, but there was some glimmer of me with him. But anyway, I lost my train because I was with my father.
Your 30s.
My 30s, years of accomplishment. I would work all the time. So I did the show, and then I also did the Larry Sanders Show at the same time. And at a certain point, they wanted me to write more episodes of Sanders when I wasn't there. And I had an overall deal at Disney. And I went to the head of Disney and said, I know this is probably not kosher, but could I keep writing episodes? And he goes, well, I really like the show. And your episodes are really good. So, okay. And I actually got to write the Larry Sanders Show while I was an overall deal.
Oh, my God. With Disney. The Larry Sanders Show, I mean, that's one of the highlights of my viewing life.
Yeah, it was great.
Larry Sanders. He was fabulous.
Great. Yeah. Just great.
And you worked with, on that show, was it on that show that you, oh, no, no, it was the film that you worked with, Billy Crystal. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I had worked, you know, in fact, I got the Larry Sanders Show because of a connection to Billy. Billy had done an HBO series a long time ago called Sessions, which was about a guy in therapy. And I can't remember who was. I think Michael McKean may have been in it.
Uh-huh.
Only one season, and I ended up, I don't know how, writing an episode of that. So I met Billy, and I also met a guy named Fred Barron, who was a wonderful guy who's in the
Fred
business.
Barron,
you know,
yes.
Fred, sure. He's a real mensch. So when the Sanders Show started, it was Fred and Gary. And he called me and said, are you going to be off soon? Because maybe you can come over. You can be like a consulting producer. I said, yeah, I would love to come. And I would say within a week, Fred was fired, and I was there, sort of stuck. So I ended up taking his place and really helping Gary with the casting and the especially the writing. But from the beginning, from the very beginning of that show,
had some groundbreaking TV.
Oh. Yeah,
yeah.
And I remember thinking at the time, "Huh, this is an odd show. Like this has never been done. Is this going to work? Because it seemed so. It didn't push." You know, it certainly didn't push. It made the audience come to it. You know?
Yeah.
And the audience did.
And boy, did we ever.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, interesting question that I've always wondered about. When you're writing for a show that you did not create.
Yes.
So there are these characters and you have to work inside of this world mm-hmm. that someone else has created. How does one prepare? Like, how do you know what to write for these characters? You know, because you have to get a sense of their internal life and you're dropping in a world that you didn't create.
Yeah.
How does that work? And is there an easy explanation?
I think it probably goes back to sort of the whole spec script idea. And I don't know that that's still used nowadays. People still write specs, but they also do a lot more original writing to try and get work. But the idea of a spec script was to show that you could do those two things, that you could, one was be funny
yeah.
and write well and all that, but that you could write somebody else's characters and somebody else's show. So again, Diane English, who created Murphy Brown, I know for a fact that if you sent her a script and there was a character named Eldon, who was the painter who lived in Murphy's house, never went away, His character name is, I believe, I'm going to get this probably backwards, but Eldon. And if you sent a spec script in and it was spelled Eldin into the trash.
Wow.
She stopped reading because she said, you didn't care enough to get it right. So why should I read it? Which makes sense.
Yeah. Which makes sense, you know? Unless it was a typographical and she missed a great piece of writing.
Exactly. Exactly. But, you know, that is an interesting conundrum for a writer, because you're saying, look at me and look at my ability while I mimic perfectly what you've created.
Mm.
It's really tough. It seems to sort of work at opposite goals.
So were you your imagination, were you kind of hone things for their writing? Like, will you edit out things that you might have written, be a little less free, or is that the art of it, finding that freedom in those confines?
Yeah, you're hopeful that you can somehow get your voice in there.
Yeah.
In a way that doesn't distract, so that, you know, people, like another example I remember was people would always say, oh, I read a spec script and it was a Seinfeld and there was a fantasy sequence. And you go, that's a bad spec script, because there wouldn't, they never did them.
Right.
They never did them. So it's that.
But
kind
how
of
did
thing.
You come to create? He wrote and created Rescue Me.
I had worked with Dennis Leary. We did a show for ABC, regretfully, that was called The Job, which was a really funny half hour, but one of the first single camera half hour comedies. Dennis had done a movie, a remake of The Thomas Crown Affair, in which he played a detective. And they assigned a New York City detective to be his technical advisor. And this guy's life was crazy, like crazy. I think maybe, if I'm getting it right, he was divorced but lived across the street from his ex-wife.
Uh-huh.
So he could see the kids, but he was also spying. It was crazy. I might be getting that wrong. So we did that show, and it was a season and a half. And I was directing episodes of the show, and I was directing an episode on 9/11. And that touched off a whole week of, you know, trying to get back. I was shooting in New Jersey, trying to get back into the city and whatever. And at one point, Dennis had friends who were in the FDNY, and we went down to Ground Zero, and we were just looking over this amazing devastation. And I said to him, yeah, this is the show we should be doing. These guys. Like, what's this going to be like going forward? Forget about right now. What's this going to be like a year from now or 2 years? Like, how are they going to process this? And this is before you even knew that there were going to be health issues or psychological issues or anything like that.
Right.
And then I promptly forgot about it, because that's my particular brilliance. I forgot about it. And about a year later, Dennis had a
– You forgot about the whole idea for the show.
Oh, sure, yeah. I think he started to think it was a movie and may have moved in that direction or done a little work or whatever. But he finally called me about a year later and said, okay, I think we should do that show you were talking about. And I was like, what show are you talking about? He said the one about the guys. And so we went to New York. I met with some real firefighters and talked to them. We based some of the characters on some of the real people we met and did it.
And I forget, did you start before 9/11 and include 9/11?
It was at – we started with – I'm going to try and remember. That's a good question, because I think we showed it. I think we showed it was probably after, but we showed flashbacks to his character working on the pile and finding the head of a coworker and, you know, that spoke to him and these weird kind of things. So I think we started after, because one of the interesting things about Rescue Me is I think it's a good show. I mean, it was not wildly consistent, but I think it was a good show.
And it was funny.
And it was – that was the thing.
Yeah.
It was also really funny.
Really funny.
And we had to figure out that balance, which we did fairly early on. As dark as it got in an episode, it had to be that funny on the other side, so it would all balance out.
Yeah.
But in the course of doing it, you know, I don't know if you ever do this. If you ever think to yourself, well, why am I doing this show, and what is the mission statement behind this show, or what is the central question I'm trying to answer? And it wasn't until the third season, we were on set or something, and we were shooting something, and I said to Dennis, oh, God, I know what the show's about. Third season, I said this to him. I said, it's about a guy survives 9/11, and now we're watching to see if he'll survive. That's it. And you see all the destruction that he does to himself and his family and his friends. And
he survived 9/11.
He survives in his life. Exactly. He survives the event,
yeah.
But will he survive the after effects of the event and what he lives with because of the event? And it's funny because then every time we said, does this work? We'd go right back to that idea and write to it. But it was very difficult. It was a really difficult thing, especially because we knew people who had been impacted, their families had been impacted by it, and we never wanted it to look like we were using the event.
Right.
You know, it was tough because it was...
You've faced your degree of difficulty in this life.
Well, yeah.
You indicated you were married a second time.
Yes.
So... The second time, where were you living? Was it here?
I was in LA. Yes, I met my second wife working on Larry Sanders, as a matter of fact.
Working
she was
on
an
Larry
editor.
Right.
And we moved to Pasadena for some years and then up to Montecito.
And Montecito. Did you have children with both
yes,
wives?
Yes, I have my oldest son is with my first wife, and they have a son and a daughter with my second wife.
And.
Then.
Then. Then you learned something about yourself
yes.
that you hadn't known or maybe had suspicion of.
I would have only had a suspicion looking back. I was not a person who was tortured about my life or like, oh, I wish I could be honest with the people in
right.
my life or anything. I didn't have that. I was very happy with my wives, especially with my second wife, it's very happy. But it's during the time that I had was doing Rescue Me, actually, I would spend a month in California with my family and then a month in New York working on the show, and I would be directing while I was there. So it was pretty intensive. But I started to have the impulse, and I don't know why someone has this impulse, I had the impulse to be with men. And I started to follow through with that. And... was you know fearful.
You would call it more an impulse than a biological need.
It felt initially like an impulse. I'm going to say initially it felt like an impulse, and it felt very natural to me. And at a certain point, I realized that the thing that I was looking for, I was not going to find the way I was going about it. Most of the ways that men meet other men are purely a sexual transaction.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want that. I wanted to have actually an emotional relationship with another man. And once I realized that, I was like, well, that's never going to happen. It's just not going to happen. I can't sort of put myself out there that way. And then I did. And then I did meet a man who I've been with.
Going through your own in-house version of transparent.
Yeah, and really painful on both sides, because the first side was trying to figure out what it meant. Like, why am I doing this? What do I really want from this? Is this me? I just didn't know. And then denial and, you know, justification, stupid things that
right.
I would say. And then realizing at a certain point, I went, oh, this is who I am. This is actually me. And I have to tell people. I have to tell the people that I love the most. I have to tell my wife and my children.
Did you see a therapist of any kind to talk about it?
Once I came to that understanding, I meant to go home and immediately tell my wife. And when I got home, she said, our friend, we had a mutual friend, but a very dear friend to her, who she'd grown up with and we'd worked with, had been diagnosed with stomach cancer. And she said, you know, she was really going to throw herself into his treatment, which she did. And I would say about a year later, a little less, he passed away. I just didn't feel like I could come home and when she gives me that news and go, and I'm gay, you
mm-hmm.
know. So I had to wait.
Mm-hmm.
And as I waited and waited and lived this lie, which was terrible, she noticed something was wrong. She said, you should see a therapist. You should see somebody. And I went to the therapist and I said, look, most people will come to you and they say, I don't know what's wrong. I said, I know what's wrong. I'm gay. I have to tell my wife. I don't know how to do it. I used to have dreams at night of words going by, like on a carousel.
Mm-hmm.
And I would pluck at the words to try and put them at the right order to explain to her what I was feeling, how it happened. And I could never get them in the right. It would just, that's what I would wake up to.
Mm-hmm.
So the therapist said, well, why don't you tell her here? Which I did. And it was that was the beginning of the next chapter of absolute misery.
Had she any guess that she was totally shocked?
No, Norman. I am the paragon of masculinity, as you know. So, no, she had no clue.
Well, for the people who are listening, you are, you could say paragon of masculinity.
I'm really not.
You're a great-looking guy and very much a guy. And
yeah, yeah. So she had no idea. In fact, she thought when I said it to her, she thought it was a joke, which didn't help. By the way, in that moment, that's not where you want to have to work back from.
And at this moment, the kids had no guess.
I had to tell her first.
Of course. So then.
And then what do you do next? Do you live together? And
I said to her, I'm here for you and I'm not going anywhere. The gay cruise is not leaving until the 15th. I forget what I said. But I said, I'm here. I'm here for you as long as you need me. You know, as long as it's going to be helpful.
There was no other person. There was that
man that I had met, but he was a good person and said, "It's however long it takes, and I'm not going to pressure you, and you do what you need to do." Mm-hmm. So I said, "I'll be here," and I was in the house. I then told my children, and then told my sisters.
You tell them separately or together?
Together. That with my second wife told, and then went and told my oldest son, who wept when I told him. And I thought, I've now caused some psychic break on my poor kid. And I said, it's okay, honey. It's okay. It's going to work out. And he said, no, I'm just happy you get to live your life the way you want to.
Wow. You know, as you said, he wept. That's exactly what I thought he wept for.
Yeah.
Because he...
That's a good moment.
Happy for you. It's a great moment.
It's a good moment for a parent because you go, oh, I sort of raised this kid, you know, and that's his response. And my sister, one of my sisters has a son who's about my oldest son, same age, and he's very quiet. He's a very quiet man, you know, he doesn't say much and is hard to read. And he heard my sister taking the call when I told her. And he said to her, tell Uncle Peter that we love him and support him. I'm just like, where does that come from with these kids? You know, it's so great.
So great.
Yeah, that's amazing.
So that, then and then it was just a question of telling my parents. And that was, you know, a mixed bag.
So they lived in Massachusetts.
Yes. Yes, they're still
And you there. Went back to Massachusetts.
I told them on the phone.
You told them on the phone.
Because I couldn't, you know, who wants to travel for that?
Yeah.
It's easier on the phone, right?
How old are you at this point?
I'm going to say this is 7 years ago, so I'm 52, like early 50s.
Did you have any inkling early in your life or during your teens or anything? Was there?
No, I didn't. There was only one thing happened was that, I had to go backwards and try and think, was there anything? But they were all like inconsequential things.
Right, yeah.
There was nothing, anything that you would go, well, this is where this is going to go. Nor, again, did I ever feel like, oh, I wish I could live my life. I didn't have that. So I think it's unusual. But once I came to the realization, then I didn't fight it. I just said, this is it, and I have to do something about it.
What an amazing story. When is this going to be a show?
Well, there's a version of it. There's actually a version of it.
It's incredible. The world needs that.
I'm not sure. I wonder how many people want to see that show. You know, it's interesting.
I would think more than you know.
Once I came out, you know, my wife, we were sort of desperate to try and find out, well, how can I help her through this, you know? So you go on the internet, of course, and you go, you put in, my husband's gay, what do I do now? Or you put, you know, dealing with your husband is gay. But there's nothing. There's absolutely nothing. You'd think maybe there'd be something. But we found one thing that said it would take 3 years for every year of marriage to recover or get life back to whatever. And that's about what happened. It's very strange.
3 years for every year of marriage.
Right. Yeah. It's almost like dog years.
So if you were married to this woman for 10 years, it would take you 30 years?
It would take you 3 years. Is it? I hope that's not me. Am I dinging?
Oh, we phones go off here on this show. we're a very cell phone friendly podcast.
Okay,
Norman's good. Liable to answer it and have a conversation on the air.
That's okay. He can do that. He gets the right. Yeah.
Wow, that's an amazing story.
Yeah, and truly horrible. Truly horrible.
I can't imagine anything more difficult.
Yeah, it's still difficult.
But you tell me how.
My partner and I bought a house in Mar Vista.
Is it the same fellow that?
Same person.
Same person.
Yes. We moved into it about 6 months ago, I think.
Right.
6 or 7 months ago. And just this is how it happens. It was the end of the night. I was walking to bed. There's a long hallway to the master bedroom. And I walked and I just stopped walking and I went, why am I not in the same house with my children? It just came over me like this thing, you know, that there was the regret and that sense of not the contact, you know. Now that my children are off in college and sort of spread out, so it's not the same thing, but it's like I said to my daughter the other day, I said, you know, it's funny, I never dream about my partner. I dream about your mother. Like if there are things that are happening and you're going someplace in a dream, I'm with her.
Mm-hmm.
It hasn't switched over on that other level. So I think that at least it's better than it was before coming out when I'd wake up at 3 o'clock and go, how am I going to do this? How am I going to make this happen?
Well, who has the biggest problem with it? Any of the children or the ex-wife? Or?
The children have different levels of interest. Because it's my life, obviously they have their interest is only borderline, you know, it's not their life.
And they've met your partner.
Yes, they've all met him. My oldest son lived with us for a number of months, so they know each other rather well. And my daughter is the youngest. She was at the time much younger. She's now 19, but I think she was more like, oh, this is cool. My dad's gay. Like it was all about her in a way. She was like, I got a gay dad. This is fantastic. So she also, I would say my partner has the most in common with my 19-year-old daughter than anyone else. So, you know, they're into the same things in terms of music, and he's up on all of these things, you know, that I'm not. Mm-hmm. So they really get along well. My middle son has no real interest. It's not aggressive at all, and he's not.
How old is he?
He's 20.
Uh-huh.
He just turned 21 in October. And I think he's just, you know, good for you. Don't really care. Doesn't really interact, hasn't interacted much with my partner. So, but it's nothing, there's no judgment there, you know. I think everybody's good. Perhaps, you know, when you come out, people tell you stories about coming out. And some of them are sad, some are funny. But somebody told me a story. A guy, three brothers in New York, and the mother's passed away. And they have a weekly dinner with their father. And the father is, they're all successful. They're doctors and lawyers and everything like this. But the youngest one's gay. And they go, you got to tell dad. You can't hide. You got to be a man. You got to tell him, you know, whatever. So he goes, all right, I'll tell him at dinner. And they have the dinner. And the brothers are enjoying this because they can't wait for this to happen, right? So they go, dad, he's got something to tell you. And he goes, well, you know, dad, it's been a long time and this is the thing, but I'm gay. And the father says, pass the potatoes. And they all laugh, right? Because they think, okay, he knew or he whatever. And the son goes on and he tries to explain. I said, I would have told you sooner, but it's just this thing and what I felt and so forth and whatever. And the father says, pass the potatoes. He didn't want to hear it. That's what it was. He just sort of said, this is too much, or I don't want to deal with this, or I'm horrified, or who knows. But he didn't want to discuss it, so he just kept saying that. And I think I have a version of that in my own life.
With your own parents?
With my father, especially, yeah.
So this is, how long has it been, Peter?
Either 6 or 7 years. I keep forgetting. Maybe I want to forget that period, but I think it's six.
And your father has never discussed it with you?
No, I've started to get a little more rebellious, I guess, because every now and then when I'm with them, I will say my partner's name, you know, in the course of conversation, which I don't know if it even.
But your partner won't be there.
No,
no.
I don't think my partner will ever meet my father. And it's not aggressive. It's, again, it's a very New England kind of like,
yeah.
We're not talking about this.
Yeah. Has he met your mom?
Nope.
Oh.
But my mother never doesn't really travel. I've been in California all these years. My parents have come out two times, three times maybe.
Are they close to the grandchildren?
Yeah. My daughter goes to school in Boston now, and she loves to hang out with her grandparents. So it's nice.
Right.
Yeah.
When I came out as a Democrat to my father, we still haven't talked about that.
Just as painful, right?
Just for him. Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow, that's an amazing story you
have. It is an amazing story. It's as amazing as anything you've been writing in this career of yours.
I think soon after, probably within the first year, a number of writer friends said, well, you got to write about this.
Yeah. That's
and right. I said, no, I can't. I can't. I'm still living it. I'm living with the after effects of it with my wife. And I said, I can't imagine being able to have the perspective on it to make something entertaining or enjoyable about it, you know?
Now, but with time.
So
do take notes.
I have. And there is a show. So there is a show. It's in a very early stage at YouTube and – you know, it's definitely a version of events with many, many liberal changes that, you know.
Well, yeah.
But definitely there are parts of it when I think about the script, which hasn't been written yet, but when I think about the story outline to it, I go, I live that. I know exactly what that moment is. I can write it with my eyes closed. I can feel it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I so much appreciate that you're able to get into it and talk about it and tell it. Because telling you, Paul, and people listening, though Peter and I are working together, and I saw him earlier today and yesterday and so forth, and we knew we were doing this podcast, I didn't ask him if I could talk about this or if I would talk about this or if I would ask him a question or something. And not that I didn't wish to, it didn't come up and I didn't think to do it and it didn't occur. But to be able to ask somebody who's been through what you've been through a couple of questions and then find a complete conversation about it is, I can't think of anything healthier.
I thought perhaps, and now I've heard a couple other stories of men my age and this same thing has happened. So I know it doesn't happen, but I thought after I did this that somebody would come to me and go, oh, my God, I'm living the same thing. What can you tell me? What can I? But that's never happened.
It's not.
Never.
Well, it's got to be hard. So hard. Maybe they're at that point where that's where the show would come in handy for a lot
of
people.
Yeah, I guess so.
But you don't seem to live with any regret that you didn't know 30 years earlier.
No, I really have had a great, enjoyable life, you know?
That's wonderful.
Where I did things I wanted to do, and I got three glorious kids. I love my kids so much. I just took them on a trip to Japan for 9 days or 10 days.
That's right.
We just got back like a week ago. And that was a great gift just to have that much time with them. Forget about Japan, which is lovely, but just to spend that much time with my kids. And, you know, both of my wives, lovely people, obviously love my second wife very much, you know. I'm still dreaming that she's my wife, so who, you know. But so there's...
And she totally understands.
I don't know that she totally... I'm not sure that she totally understands. It's now something that's 6 years old or whatever, and we don't really discuss it that much. But she would, for the first couple of years, just look at me and go, this is really what's happening, right? I mean, there are things that you're doing with another man, right, that maybe I don't want to know. And I go, I'll tell you. I mean, it's nothing out of the ordinary. But she's a wonderful person, and she has been able to bless me in this new part of my life.
That's extraordinary.
Really extraordinary.
And I get the suffering that had to go on.
I will just think back to even, you know, the Thanksgivings or if the Thanksgiving before I could tell her. And you're sitting at your table surrounded by your family and people you love, and you're at the head of the table carving a turkey and going, nobody at this table knows me. And that's my memory of that particular moment. Nobody knows me. And that's pretty solitary, you know?
There's got to be great freedom now in having it all out there. Is there? Or is that a work in progress?
It's much better. But, you know, I grew up Catholic in Massachusetts. So guilt is a primary.
Philadelphia
Catholic school. Yeah, sure. It's, I think, for anybody raised in religion, guilt is the primary factor. So I, you know, if I don't hear from my ex-wife in a couple of days, I'm like, is she okay? Is this the, you know, has it turned? I mean, is she now going to, is there going to be a kitchen knife waiting for me the next time I go up there? So you think that stuff. You can't leave that behind. And I just, I think I worry about her more than I have to, but I still do. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I can imagine that.
You know, when you say, you suggest that with this thing about Catholic guilt, that of course it would exist. I'm sensing in our world some Catholic understanding also, maybe since Francis came along.
It certainly is a different thing.
It would be wonderful to have him in a podcast here.
Oh, exactly.
I would love that.
And find out what our current pope. But my sense of our current pope is he would understand. He would tolerate. I don't like the word tolerate. He would understand.
Accept. He'd be completely accepting, I think. I don't know if the church is there yet, but the pope certainly is. And this pope... Yeah. Being raised Catholic, the infallibility of the Pope and all of that, you know, the Pope is just one notch under God, Jesus Christ on this earth. Mm-hmm. And so he should – he's that the great, good, loving father. I never got it from – just intrinsically, I never got it from any of the popes until this guy. He seems like what they taught us, what the Pope was, truly – understanding, accepting, warm, loving, not all punishing. The other guys always looked a little cold to me.
Well, they had side businesses that we didn't know about.
Yeah.
You know, they had deals with the Jews. They had all sorts of things working. But I think that, and I don't know, I'm not enough of a student of religion over time, but I wonder if religion is a thing that has a shelf date, that has an expiration date. Because when you say that the Pope is the mouthpiece of God, he's the person on earth who's the closest to God.
Infallible.
Infallible at a certain point, and is it? And who knows if it's just our generation or whatever living through, let's say, Nixon or a Watergate where you suddenly lose faith in politics and all that. So you realize that people lie as institutions are sometimes based on lies, that you sometimes go, well, wait a minute, infallible? He's a guy. I mean, he's a dude, right? I mean, you know, if it was a woman, maybe. If it was my mother, maybe infallible. If the Pope was my mother, I'd be going, she's right. Don't start with her. Believe me, you'll end up with a bar of soap in your mouth. But that seems like such a quaint idea now, I think, to a lot of people.
So, but I think that's why they get you early enough.
Well, yeah.
Look at a first grader. And they're drumming into them. The concept For example, the concept of hell.
Mm-hmm.
Look at a first grader. They're not ready for that. Do you know what I mean? They're not ready for hell and another day of suffering. You know what tomorrow is? Another day of suffering forever.
A first grader, when you say hell, they go, yeah, kindergarten. I will live through that shit. You know,
Wow. That's what they should be doing. But then they're giving you this information. So they start – anyway, they start getting you early and then –
But isn't
so there... I think it stops you asking any questions. So the infallible – I know really smart people – and I don't question, what do I know? I don't know anything. This is an observation. I know really facile, smart thinking people that when it gets to this stuff, they believe in Noah's Ark and they believe in the infallibility of the Pope and they believe in you sit at the right hand or the left hand and all this very simplified stuff. I'm not saying I know what's right or wrong.
But is that comfort? Is because it's learned at a young age, is it just
that's
comfort?
That's what it's got to be.
It's got to be it, right?
And they won't be knocked off of that.
Whatever gets the individual through the day and night, whatever is working.
I agree.
It's reasonable.
Right.
I agree.
It doesn't impact other people.
It does, yes, especially
if it doesn't do
if
that.
If it doesn't impact.
But is there a problem with the fact that if you, it's almost like programming, so that as you grow through life, one of the great things for me is searching and trying to figure mm-hmm. out and asking mm-hmm. questions and at this point being okay with no answer but more questions, right? And obviously, you know, you've done some searching, some learning about yourself. As you, Does it thwart that? Does it stop that? Does it kneecap that?
Probably.
Yeah, I think
but
so.
But if it does and it makes for that person's life, then that's what it took for that person.
But look at
that. But so does drugs.
Yeah. Look at the number of people who say, a number of Catholics who say, I'm a lapsed Catholic. They're still identifying as Catholic.
Right.
They're wearing it almost as a badge of honor. They're saying, I belong still, just not as much. That's how ingrained those ideas are from youth.
Yeah.
That you go, I belong. Because, you know, when you're a kid, that's all it's about. I belong to something. There's something bigger than me. And that's probably why religion, they get you early. Right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Whatever is good for you or whoever you is in this instance, whatever, you know, that doesn't interfere with anybody else's, is good and reasonable and right.
Right, where it doesn't interfere with
anybody
else.
The fact that you enjoy searching and so forth, I do too, doesn't make either of us any more special than the person who has gotten the answers because they are, you know, they've been taught them in Sunday school. They took them away. They've worked with them all their lives, and they're living fruitful lives.
Yeah. Where it doesn't impact someone else negatively.
We're no more special for being the curious people who are open to everything.
Right.
But we're special because we're in showbiz.
Say again.
God, no.
I'm kidding.
All sorts of problems. Well, you, I've read your book. I actually read your book before I met you.
Yes.
So, were you raised Jewish? Were you raised by both parents, or were you?
We were culturally. No, I was bar mitzvahed, but my parents were not religious. They didn't go to synagogue Friday night or Saturday morning. When my father went to prison, I lived with an uncle, and then I wound up with my grandparents. Mm-hmm. My grandfather went to shul, to synagogue, and I went with him often because I lived with him for almost 3 years. And I would say he was religious. Mm-hmm. And my grandmother was in the kitchen. She didn't go anywhere. And she was...
But when he went, did you go?
I went often enough.
It held no allure for you?
But it held no, it didn't.
You know, when I was in college, you know, once you go to college, of course, you actually meet Jewish people. It's fantastic. That's what most colleges should actually have a course. But you have friends all of a sudden who are Jews. And you go, well, that's interesting. I always wanted to have a Jewish. And I met a lot of my Jewish friends who are men. And I wished, oh, God, if I'd only been a Jew. Because the relationships they had, especially with their mothers, where their mothers would say, you are the prince. You can do anything. I believe you move the stars, the sun, you know. If only I'd had that instead of my own mother going, look, moderation, you're not that great. Don't pat yourself on the back. You know, I just wish, oh, now I know you didn't have that relationship.
I didn't have that.
So maybe my theory is faulty.
I had a mother that when I tell the story about having called her to tell her they were starting a Hall of Fame and I was going to be in the Hall of Fame, she said, listen, she said, if that's what they want to do, who am I to say? I tell that to big audiences all the time and get the laugh I'm getting now.
That's right.
And that was with Uncle Milty and Patty Chayefsky.
And the reason I get it is because people relate to it. So many of them had that mother.
That's right.
Yeah. When the writers of The Middle, I do a recur on a show called The Middle on ABC.
Okay.
And he's a guitar playing reverend. Okay. And I told my mom that they've written this role for me and isn't this great? And she said, that's wonderful, yeah. And I said, and also I'm going to be writing, he's a singer and a guitar player, so I'll be writing the songs. And she said, you forced your songs on them too? And when I got to the point where I just held the phone, I said, okay, Mom, let's unpack that. The amount of therapy that it would have taken.
Did you say that to her?
I actually did.
And did you get to a place with her where she was able to say to you why she said that?
No, she tells me to shut up.
No, oh
no, she doesn't say shut up.
But
she just laughs
about it. I would love to know
it.
Where that comes from.
My mom, when I was talk about like the difference of, you know, you're the prince and all that.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so I'm starring in a Broadway show. I've got a Tony nomination, all this wonderful stuff. And my mom comes to the theater, and after the show, she's in my dressing room, and I'm getting changed. And my dresser is there. And he's handing me shirt and stuff and mm-hmm. all, what dressers do. And then, you know, they were – actually, this was when I was in London doing the show. And they were there for the week. And the second or third night she was there, we're in the dressing room. And not that I was starting to think I was fancy or anything, but you do have – there's certain things that – you know. And my mother, I was putting my shirt on, and I reached into the closet, and I took my shirt out. My mother, oh, well, look at him. He's going to get dressed all by himself. That was her take on the whole thing. It all came down to this.
I'm going to have dreams tonight.
Oh, look, he's going to get dressed all by himself, really.
Oh, big shot.
There's something about that that does keep you honest.
Well, I don't need to be kept that honest.
Well, that's
that's it. You know, years, years I wrote about the Writers Guild was going to do a book of essays, and it was called The First Time I Got Paid for It. It was a very evocative title. You know, they put sort of a pulp woman on the front and everything. It was supposed to be about the first time you get paid for writing. And I wrote instead about a sort of a Shaggy Dog story about doing a show in high school, the first time I knew I was going to be a writer. And I wrote this story, and the story is very much about how wonderful I was in a high school production of Bye Bye Birdie, playing the Dick Van Dyke part. So much so that I knew that I would go home and my mother would be waiting up to say, "You've done it. Broadway is next. Yeah. We're so proud of you," so forth. So I came in ready for her to say that, ready for her to say that. I said, "Well, what did you think?" And my mother said, "I think you're going to be a writer."
Speaking of, what is there about motherhood across the board?
I think there's
that results in a lot of that.
Let's be generous and say it's just protection. They're just trying to protect us.
Yeah. Not thinking too much of ourselves.
Don't think too much of yourself.
No, but speaking of being a writer and a writer, you guys are working together on your new show that you told me about years ago. So you've had this idea for a long time.
Yes.
Guess Who Died? And how's that working together?
We're having a good time.
Just great.
Yeah.
It's terrifying.
It's got to be. But do you ever just go like, you've worked with everyone, but now you're working with Norman Lear.
I had only met Norman maybe 2 or 3 months before, and we hit it off, and then this thing came up, and I said, yes, I want to do it. But the first thing I said to him was, tell me what I shouldn't cut when I go through the script. Just tell me, because I was so afraid that I would do the thing, and he would go, who is this guy?
It could not be more interesting that just today I called Michael. Michael is the associate of our producer, Brent Miller, and I said, Michael, find that piece of the mother who's talking to her son, who turns out to be after she puts him down,
and so
in many ways, on his side of the phone, they're saying they're ready for you now, Governor, and he's the governor of Rhode Island or something.
And
we've been talking about these mothers.
Yep.
And this, because I want to cast that role. I want to hear that role read.
Yeah, you're exercising something there. There's a demon I think you're actually trying to get rid of there.
So you,
oh my God, so
you, you got the script and had to do a little editing.
Yeah, I think I've created a couple of other characters.
Yeah, no, he's done some wonderful work.
And we had to do some third act stuff and everything like that. But there's just, you know, there's things that I could not do in that script that he can do. And people are going, oh, your script is wonderful. It's really good. And I go, yeah, well, thank God, because Norman fills in stuff that I can't do. There are really wonderful, true emotional moments in that script that were in the script you read. That are still there and still powerful, that people say to us, that part got me.
You know? Yeah.
But they are there and they're cousins to brand new stuff that's also terrific.
Yeah.
In the same way.
Yeah.
You know, we are on some kind of path.
Very exciting.
But, you know, it's – he does – I'm sure you don't think about this, and I certainly don't, although some people have come up to me in my own life, but not like you. Where I told him when I first met him, my parents gave me a cassette recorder. This is in the 70s, a cassette recorder. And this is how stupid I was, why I didn't figure out I was going to be a writer. I would tape record television shows off the TV and listen to them at night as I fell asleep because I found the laughs comforting.
Wow.
Okay?
Wow.
And I would fall asleep listening to the laughter from All in the Family. And by the way, those laughs were real.
They were real.
Yeah.
They were real and powerful. Those are powerful laughs. And so, you know, Norman is one of those people who taught me how to write before I knew I was going to be a writer and has this influence on whole generations, not just a generation, generations of writers who learned from him. So it's a little daunting.
Yeah.
In other words, to work with him. But
well, this seems like a really nice place to close.
Plus, he's so mean, right? And he's yelling all the time.
A bastard.
And hitting people.
He's a bastard.
Oh, my God.
95, but still the upper body strength.
That punch. When he grabbed you by the throat.
Oh, my God.
So we conclude this podcast as I'm reminded. And it is unbelievable to me that I am 95. Actually 95. I started to get applause for standing when I turned 90. And 5 years later, I get an ovation if I cross a room. And then I hear all this lovely stuff from Peter Tolan.
Yeah.
And from Paul Hipp. And closing with that lonely stuff, this is Norman Lear with Peter Tolan and Paul Hipp. And this has been All of the Above.
What does it mean, this life, this day and night?
So I'm Norman Lear, and you can find me, should you wish to hunt me down, you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at The Norman Lear.
And you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Paul Hipp.
Some of nine, and life is good, and space and time. Give me some of yours, I'll give you some of mine.
Hey guys, it's Caitlin Bristow with Off the Vine. Last year was so great, and I'm kicking off the new year with a bang. I'm adding a mini episode each week. I'm going to answer your questions, take your confessions, and just so much more. So check out new episodes of Off the Vine every Tuesday and the new mini episodes starting Thursday, January 11th, exclusively at podcastone.com and the Podcast One app. Plus, remember to rate and review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps me out.